Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is internationally renowned philosopher Judith Butler. Butler's latest book, Parting Ways, Jewishness and the Critique of Zionism, continues her efforts to disaggregate Zionism and Jewishness, to articulate an ethical foundation for democratic politics, to reevaluate hate speech, and to rethink the grounds of state formations in ways that preempt state violence. Listen to what she writes in opening the book.
What started as a book seeking to debunk the claim that any and all criticism of the state of Israel is effectively anti-Semitic has become a meditation on the necessity of tarrying with the impossible. If I succeed in showing that there are Jewish resources for the criticism of state violence, the colonial subjugation of populations, expulsions, and dispossession, then I will have managed to show that a Jewish critique of Israeli state violence is at least possible, if not ethically obligatory. If I show further that there are Jewish values of cohabitation with the non-Jew that are part of the very ethical substance of diasporic Jewishness, then it will be possible to conclude that commitments to social equality and social justice have been an integral part of the Jewish secular, socialist, and religious traditions.
Judith Butler will be giving a public lecture on April 10th at 6 o'clock at Rhodes College based on this new work titled Thinking by Nationalism with Martin Buber and Edward Said. From the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York, Judith, I'm so glad to have you with me on Counterpoint today. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Judith, philosophers are often hostile to biography, but you say in Parting Ways that you come to the values and principles in this book through your schooling and early childhood formation within Jewish communities that prompted you to study philosophy for the first time. At Rhodes, we recently screened the documentary Judith Butler, Philosophical Explorations of the Third Kind, and in the movie you discuss your childhood. I wanted to pick up on one amazing anecdote from it. You talk about how you were identified as a troublemaker as a kid, with the result that you were singled out to study alone with the rabbi rather than in the regular Hebrew school group. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing and then what you wanted to talk about to the rabbi when you were 14.
I was brought up in a very strong Zionist community in the eastern suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio. And I, along with most of my friends, went to the synagogue on the weekends to participate in Hebrew school and sometimes also after school. And I actually liked Hebrew school, not only because we were learning Hebrew, but we also had classes in ethics and we learned a good deal about Jewish history and we were able to debate political topics that interested all of us. In one of those classes, I apparently spoke out of turn, or I spoke too much, or I spoke about a topic that wasn't the topic, and once reprimanded, I made apparently a facial expression. I don't remember what facial expression it was, but it was apparently registered in a negative way by my teacher. And I was told that I was unruly and asked to leave the classroom, and apparently that particular teacher wasn't very fond of me and said that he wanted me to take a tutorial with the rabbi as punishment. And I was, of course, inwardly gleeful because the rabbi was brilliant and I wanted very much to study with him. And so I came into the rabbi's office and he was very stern and he said, well, we have to do a tutorial, but you're the one who has to say what we're going to study. What are your interests? And he thought, you know, I was a petty criminal or disciplinary problem, so he didn't expect very much from me. But I did say that I wanted to study existential theology, especially the work of Martin Buber. And I wanted to know whether Nazism could be derived from German idealism. It was a disturbing thought to me because I already liked some of the German idealist philosophers. And lastly, I wanted to know why Spinoza was excommunicated from the synagogue. And I had, I guess, a sneaking suspicion that I was on my way to excommunication myself.
Well, we'll explore whether that's true or not, perhaps. but I am really interested in how did you start reading these works? I mean, this is obviously an anecdote that shows a certain precociousness. So how did you start getting into philosophy? Aside from what you've said in these classes, when did you start reading this material? How were you exposed to it? How did you expose yourself to it?
It's a strange story. I suppose like most young adolescents, I tried to find some place in the house where I could hide. And in the house where I was brought up, there was a lovely basement. It was carpeted. It had music. And I would sneak down there and lock the door And I would do a couple of things down there. I sketched, I listened to music, and I read the books that were on the shelves. And my mother apparently had taken a few philosophy classes at Vassar in the early 50s. She was one of the very first Jews, I think, to be admitted to Vassar at that time. And they included Spinoza, and I guess my father also had a copy of Schopenhauer down there. And there was Kierkegaard's Either Or. And so I started reading, and I started taking notes on what I was reading, and that then led me to go to the library and read more. And by the time, I guess I was in junior high, I asked for tutorials in philosophy. And I was given one on Plato and Aristotle, which I enjoyed enormously. And then, of course, I had the great opportunity of studying with my rabbi, and we read widely and continued our conversations for many years thereafter.
So did the issues around Zionism, politics, Jewish history, were they always a part of one aspect of your life? Or was there a time where you sort of became less concerned with those questions and more concerned with other questions and then returned to the issues that are now obviously at the center of Parting Ways?
Well, I would say they were always of concern to my life. It's true that I went to college and studied existential philosophy and phenomenology, and from there was introduced to other European philosophical traditions and ended up writing a dissertation on Hegel, for instance. I was certainly interested in the Jewish reception of Hegel, and I did a fair amount of work on that. But it wasn't what I published on, but it was certainly, what can I say, an ongoing intellectual interest to the side of my career. But I suppose when I was young, and I was sent to Israel a couple of times with groups, I was taught very clearly that the Nazi genocide against the Jews produced the necessity for a secure homeland for the Jews, a sanctuary, and that Israel was that place. And we all certainly believed that. And to question anything about the state of Israel seemed to show a kind of deep and unacceptable insensitivity to the atrocities of the Nazi genocide. So we certainly accepted that story of history. I think it slowly dawned on me that there was a population there in that land, on Palestine, who were largely dispossessed in 1948, and that there were several quite bloody military battles to establish the Jewish homeland as a Jewish homeland. So I had to rethink some of the stories I'd been told, the way that history was narrated to me, and I had to pose the question to myself whether indeed the establishment of the State of Israel on the grounds that it was established, that is to say, principles of Jewish sovereignty, whether that was necessary or whether it could have been established as a binational state, and whether that would have made a difference in the years to come, whether that would have minimized conflict and institutionalized equality between Palestinians and Jews in a substantially different way. So I did pose that question. I suppose I'm posing that question still.
And we've already framed this a little bit, that in some ways posing questions can in fact lead to excommunication. One of the ways in which this comes up has to do with the charge of anti-Semitism. Now, you've written about this most directly in your response to former Harvard president Lawrence Summers, who claimed in an address that he was worried about what many on the left, especially professors, were saying about Israel, suggesting that their criticisms of Israel were anti-Semitic in effect, if not in intent. That's a quote of his. And you suggested in response to that statement that the logic at work there can function as a form of censorship in effect, if not in intent. Why do you think it's so important that we pull apart criticism of Israel from charges of anti-Semitism? And then, as importantly, what criteria do you think about for distinguishing criticisms of Israel from statements that are anti-Semitic?
Well, first of all, let me say that, of course, there are people who criticize Israel in anti-Semitic ways, and there is anti-Semitic rhetoric to be found coming from several parts of the world that does focus on Israel. And I think every possible instance of anti-Semitism has to be opposed, and opposed absolutely. It's a place where I'm actually not a relativist, and I think, like all forms of racism, anti-Semitism has to be opposed absolutely and clearly, unequivocally. So the question is, if one wants to go back and ask, like, what was the binational alternative and does it still exist? What were people arguing about in the late 40s or even earlier when they were proposing binationalism? What did Hannah Arendt have to say? What did Martin Buber have to say? Why did they think perhaps a federated authority would be a better idea than a state built on principles of Jewish sovereignty, guaranteeing the demographic majority of Jews? If you want to ask that question historically, surely you're not necessarily anti-Semitic. You might just be wishing very deeply that Jews and non-Jews could live peaceably on that land. You might be wishing very deeply that principles of equality could be institutionalized through some new state formation, and that that would establish a more substantive, democratic, political organization for that land. So to want peace or to want equality or indeed to want democracy doesn't strike me as anti-Semitic. Indeed, there are many important generations of Jewish intellectuals and activists who have prized peace, equality, and democracy. And we have a long and glorious tradition of defending those values.
Oftentimes it is the case that invoking the kinds of claims that were made by Buber or that were made by Hannah Arendt today is often read off as anti-Semitic. And in part, this has to do with the link that seems to underpin that charge, that there is a necessary overlap between Jewishness and Zionism, between Judaism and Zionism. These are things that you've wanted to pull apart in Parting Ways. Tell us a little bit more about how these often get conflated in the discussion and why you're keen to disassemble this connection.
Jonathan, it's important to remember that when Buber and Arendt and Judah Magnus and Hans Cohen and others were debating binationalism and wondering about whether that particular form of government might be instituted on the lands of Palestine, they were Zionists. That was a Zionist argument. Binationalism was not anti-Zionist. That was a very strong and important part of the history of Zionism. And Zionists everywhere through the 30s and 40s, and surely also after the end of the Second World War, and perhaps most emphatically during 46, 47, and early 48, they were arguing this point. So you could be a Zionist and be on the side of binationalism, or you could be a Zionist and be on the side of Jewish sovereignty and Jewish demographic majority. And those were internal quarrels, both internal quarrels to Zionism. So it's only once we accepted Ben-Gurion's definition of Zionism that the binational alternative became either non-Zionist or counter-Zionist or anti-Zionist. I think we've perhaps forgotten the history of Zionism when we frame the issue in that way.
I think also one of the ways we as scholars put this is that Buber, Arendt, Cohn, etc., they were speaking from the position that we would term cultural Zionism, and they were internal critics of what we would call political Zionism. But your point of departure isn't just these cultural Zionists. Maybe we could say that it's something like what Hannah Arendt calls the tradition of conscious pariahs. But the position that you're coming out of is clearly also a departure from these traditions. It's in this sense that the title invokes parting. And that's spurred by bringing these kinds of thinkers into dialogue with Palestinian intellectual Edward Said and the poet Mahmoud Darwish. How would you situate your work in relationship to the thinkers that you invoke and embed yourself in and then depart from to forge your own philosophical position on these issues?
I understand that Buber's called a cultural Zionist, and perhaps in the 1930s, Arendt also was identified with a certain kind of cultural Zionism that focused on education and smaller experiments in socialism, some of which reemerged in the kibbutz movement, to be sure. But let's remember that in 46 and 47, Buber, Magnus, and Arendt all put forward a proposal for federated authority in Palestine. So there was a concrete proposal for a state formation that would be federated. And that binational alternative was not just cultural, it was explicitly political, and it was in favor of one kind of state rather than another. And they lost that battle, and that was a consequential loss, in my view. So my view is not that there should be pariahs or I want to be a pariah, and I don't have any particularly romantic attachment to the pariah status or indeed the status of the excommunicant. But what I do think is that we should perhaps rethink the federal model and that there might be ways to do that in the present day. And it would be interesting to know how those ideals might be transposed onto a more contemporary political landscape.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking with philosopher Judith Butler about her most recent book, Parting Ways, Jewishness and the Critique of Zionism. Judith, I think you wanted to make another point.
Well, you had asked why would I read thinkers like Arendt or Primo Levi in relationship to Edward Said and Mahmoud Darwish. And what I'm trying to do there, I suppose, is develop a strategy that many people in comparative literary studies have done, which is to bring traditions together that don't always speak to one another or don't always comment on each other to see what kinds of possibilities of cohabitation there might be on the page. And in fact, I think that one can find many overlapping commitments and ethical dispositions on both sides of that divide.
So you've mentioned now the term cohabitation. For me, at least, I think it's the most important single word that runs through all of Parting Ways. But I want to talk to you about some of the other really key terms in the course of the book. Displacement, you've already mentioned binationalism. It seems to me that part of your appeal in elaborating how you understand these notions is that you want to rethink the discourse around the Israel-Palestine conflict, which you state at one point is stuck in narrative lockdown. Saeed suggested that displacement characterizes the histories of both the Palestinians and the Jewish peoples. How do you follow his suggestion in Parting Ways? Can you talk a little bit more generally about how you are rethinking identity, nationalisms, both Jewish and Palestinian, not necessarily in the same ways, in terms of dispersion, exile, diaspora?
Well, one point that Saeed makes in his important book on Freud and the non-European is that displaced peoples in general have at their disposal a certain kind of understanding of what it is to be a refugee, an exile, to have lost one's home, to be forced from one's home, to be terrorized or indeed to be expelled. And certainly that characterizes the lives of so many European Jews who were forced to leave their homes in Europe and put in concentration camps, and some of whom survived and did find their way to Palestine and found their way to other places that served as sanctuary as well, as we know. And the question is whether that experience of displacement, which is not just an experience of the 20th century, but for the Jewish people, an experience that certainly dates back for many centuries, whether that can be marshaled really as an ethical resource for developing an understanding of what it is for another population to have been displaced. Even though I don't think Palestinians were displaced in 1948 in the same way that Jews were displaced through the Second World War, I don't mean to draw easy or facile analogies between the two. Let's affirm that those are two very radically distinct historical moments of dispossession and displacement. And yet, it seems to me that there are ways of understanding the need of the refugee for return or reparation or for sanctuary. The question, of course, is whether the State of Israel provided that for Jewish refugees, but did it provide it at the expense of Palestinians? Did it, in fact, produce a new refugee class and displace another population in order to provide sanctuary for the displaced Jewish population? And if so, it seems like there's a contradiction at the heart of that refugee policy.
Some of the ways in which you attempt to sort of unthink that contradiction has to do with your reflections on binationalism. So closely coupled in Parting Ways to reflections on displacement is a set of reflections on binationalism. This is going to be the topic of your talk in Memphis next week. I want to talk to you a little bit more about it now. You make some distinctions when you talk about binationalism between what you call wretched binationalism and your hope for a possible future for a different kind of binationalism. What do you offer in your reflections on binationalism?
I think we can say that Israeli Jews and Palestinians who are Israeli and who are without citizenship, do live in proximity to one another already. I mean, I believe 20% of the Israeli population is currently Palestinian. That is internal to the current borders of Israel and have Israeli papers or full citizenship. Then, of course, there's another several million outside in the West Bank or Gaza or elsewhere who very often do live in proximity to Israelis in the West Bank. I would say Palestinians live in proximity to the settlements. So there are ways in which Israelis and Palestinians are living side by side, both inside of the State of Israel and in the occupied territories, but they're not living side by side on the condition of equality. There are at least 48 laws in the State of Israel that disempower Palestinians, that establish their citizenship as second class. And as we know, Palestinians living in the West Bank still don't have citizenship and rights of political self-determination. So what would it mean to accept that side-by-sideness, that living in proximity with each other, but on conditions of equality rather than on conditions of hierarchy? The wretched form is the imposed form. Many Palestinians who've lost their lands as settlements were built and who live near those settlements and sometimes even service them might be said to be living a wretched form of binationalism. They live right there looking at the territory that they've lost, their homes that they've lost, but they work there and they cohabit with people who've taken them. And within Israel itself, people, we might say Palestinians and Israelis very often are in school together or living in the same neighborhood in Jerusalem and in Haifa for sure. But that doesn't mean they live on the condition of equality. What would it mean to transform that so that proximity wouldn't be riven by inequality?
And the key term, I think, in terms of how you want to rethink that has to do with the idea of cohabitation. One quick quote here from Parting Ways. You say, in opposition to the idea of the Jews as a chosen people who are supposed to bring enlightened values to the rest of the world, Arendt, again invoking Hannah Arendt, throws in her lot with the unchosen, arguing that this unchosenness is the basis of our cohabitation on earth. So unchosenness and cohabitation. What are some of the ways in which you explore unchosen cohabitation in the book that obviously has ramifications in Israel-Palestine, but not only there? In other words, say more about the way in which the de facto situation on the ground is in fact one of cohabitation, but often denied as such.
Let me respond in two different ways. Let me tell you first how I came up with that idea of the unchosen, and then let me explain how I think it might work today. When I was reading Hannah Arendt on Eichmann, I noted that she accuses Eichmann of thinking that he could choose with whom to inhabit the world. He thought he could get rid of one population or destroy a population he didn't particularly like. And she admonishes him and says it is not within the realm of choice to decide with whom you cohabit the world. We come into the world cohabiting it with others. We don't choose to come into the world. We don't choose those others who inhabit the world with us. But once we are in the world as given creatures, created, we are under an obligation to live with others and to preserve their lives and to have our own lives preserved. So I think that that was an extremely important point that she made, that there's an unchosen character to our social and political lives. We don't get to choose who can live on this earth and who cannot. If we do choose, we pursue a genocidal politics. And as we know, Arendt was emphatically opposed to genocidal politics of all sorts. And she was deriving this particular ethical precept from her opposition to genocide. And I'm not saying that Palestinians are the victims of genocide. I don't think they are. But what I want to say here is that it is imperative that we live with those we never chose to live with, and that we not decide that we can live on the earth without them or that they themselves must be expelled. Very often we live with those we don't particularly love or we don't particularly want to be close to. That happens on the bus in New York City. It happens in one's neighborhood. It happens in one's city, in one's region. Very often there are great difficulties, tensions, hostilities. And yet, under what conditions is there an overriding obligation to live with one another, even though it may well be difficult? And my sense is that there's great suspicion on the part of Israeli Jews and Palestinians, both inside and outside of Israel, about living together and what cohabitation might mean. I don't imagine it as love. I don't imagine it as harmony. I don't imagine it as some beautiful restoration. But what I do think is that all sides of that particular conflict have an obligation to live with one another on conditions of nonviolence and on conditions of equality. And that's an overriding obligation. And a commitment to that vision would, I think, go a long way in ameliorating the conflict and paving the way for a more peaceable future.
I want to ask you one more question that sort of links your earlier work to this most recent work, and specifically to sort of ask you whether or not this notion of unchosen cohabitation, which has built within it an imperative, an ethical imperative to recognize the other, but also to recognize the other inside the self, whether in fact this is a continuation of some of your thinking on issues of identity. So I want to ask you whether, akin to what you've argued about sex and gender, which is that these are not stable or fixed or natural categories, and that the norms that try to create them as such are the source of the trouble, in Parting Ways, you suggest that trying to define a polity on the basis of a split binary between Israelis and Palestinians is not tenable, and it may itself be the source of the violence that is generated by the nationalism seething in this conflict. Would you accept this way of linking your earlier and your more recent work?
I think I am sensitive to what we might call false binary oppositions. And I've, I guess, made several arguments against the false binary opposition between men and women, suggesting that there are gender variations and complications of both of those norms that should make us rethink the ease with which we decide that there are only two kinds of genders in the world. But if we think about, say, Israel and Palestine, I mean, let's just examine the following facts. I mean, there are, I believe, close to 30% of Israelis of Arab descent. So that's interesting. There, 20% of Israelis are Palestinian, non-Jewish. So that gives us nearly or more than 50% of the Israeli population as coming from Arab backgrounds. And of course, there are Palestinian Israelis and Jewish Israelis. And there is, of course, in Palestine, people from different backgrounds who are living together, and they are living in close proximity very often to Israelis who are right-wing settlers who've moved into that area, believing that it belongs to them. But of course, that claim is actively contested by most every Palestinian. In any case, there are some pretty complicated overlappings in all of these dimensions. So we shouldn't imagine that these terms are absolutely oppositional. I don't think they are.
Judith, these are complex issues, and we've only scratched the surface in terms of what you delve into in Parting Ways. At least this conversation has started us in a direction that will continue when you visit Memphis at 6 o'clock on April 10th at Rhodes College. So thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint to at least begin that conversation.
Thank you.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.